Okay, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to one more time share some little realizations and insights on this morning program. And to begin with, once again, I would like to request the blessings of all the assembled Vaishnavas so that I may say something of some little use. And as we probably know, this is not a regular Bhagavatam class here, but we do part two of, some little seminar on spiritual culture. So yesterday we had session number one, where we discussed in all details, well, not in so many details because we didn't even have so much time, but we discussed the importance of having a mentor, of having a coach who guides us and also eventually becoming one. And actually the introduction yesterday was like a little teaser for this book, because in this book I'm discussing the whole topic in so much more detail. And whoever hasn't gotten one yet, so please take the opportunity. We've got a few left out there on the book table. So, and today I want to actually introduce this book, which is entitled Spiritual Culture, Krishna's Divine System. I was sharing yesterday very briefly that because I have been serving in Bangladesh over the last 20 years, quite a fair bit of time every year, that's where I received all kinds of insights and transformations, actually. And I have established a little institute for spiritual culture, and I've put some courses together, and now I'm trying to put these courses into book form so it can reach more people. And I find this very appropriate that also today you have your Bhakti Shastri ceremony here, because I am firmly convinced that, yes, learning the Shastras, this is step number one in our educational process. But there also has to come a step number two. And that's where I'm trying to come in, by actually giving some systematic education how our philosophy is meant to be lived. And we are not quite there yet, actually. So, yes. In any case, I'm calling this book Spiritual Culture, Krishna's Divine System, and it is basically trying to introduce our Vaishnav culture as Krishna's system, which he gives us to create stability and harmony in this world, so that we can wholeheartedly develop our relationship with him. And I consciously call it spiritual culture and not Vedic culture or Vaishnav culture, because actually we can see that in any culture where God is the center, where God consciousness is the goal in life, we will find the same principles. So throughout the book, I'm often making comparisons to other spiritual cultures, to Christianity, and we can see that actually 100 years ago, not that long ago, we could find the same principles also in Christianity. But then what happened, when economic development increases, then sense gratification gets put as goal of life, and that pushes the spiritual culture aside. And that we have also experienced in India massively, because India over the last 20, 30 years has experienced such economic boost, right? I mean, I came to India first time 30 years ago, so now it's a whole different story in India. So, and that exactly, that economic development puts sense gratification as goal in life rather than God realization. And that pushes this Buddha Krishna, this Buddha culture to the side. And materialism sets in. So that's what we can observe in India now. So, and I'm firmly convinced, because actually the underlying principles of Krishna's culture, they are universal. They are universal. And they are always valid, actually, because it's Krishna's system. So, if we understand the principles of Krishna's culture, then we will know how to apply it. But if we don't understand the principles, then very easily we get confused over the details. Right? Yes. And this is exactly what has happened in all other spiritual cultures, that the principles got lost in the name of modernizing and reforming. So in the name of modernizing and reforming, we lost the principles in Christianity, for example. And that has led to the fact that the spiritual power and contents got lost and things became diluted. So, and my concern is that this cannot happen in Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement. So that's why I feel this urgent need to educate our devotees in the underlying principles of Krishna's culture. Yes, we have to know the principles. And then it is up to each and everyone where we want to be here, you know, how much of which culture we want to invite in our life. So these are just a few introductory words. So on this discussion, because we are very limited in time, I just want to stick to a few general principles without getting lost in some discussions over little details, because in this book I'm going through so many details, but we won't have the time for this. So I just want to present some little food for thought and give a few little general principles. So to begin with, let us understand how culture comes about. So culture comes about by living a certain worldview. That's how culture manifests in all different aspects of practical life. And of course, there's only the main two cultures in this world. There's materialistic culture and there's spiritual culture. And they are based on very different worldviews, completely opposite, 180 degrees. Material life is all about sense gratification. Sex life is the all in all. There's only one life, the understanding is, you know, only one life, so let's enjoy it to the max. There's no understanding that there's further reactions for our activities in this life. There's no understanding that we are meant to qualify ourselves to get out of here. We see ourselves as the supreme enjoyer, controller, proprietor of everything. We are in the center. What's in it for me? How can I use everyone and everything for my enjoyment and gratification? It's completely based on bodily concept. It actually increases bodily identification with the gross body and the subtle body also. Materialistic culture is all about blowing up and feeding the subtle body of mind, intelligence, false ego, especially false ego. I've got a whole separate course on that. Realizing, this topic of false ego is such an important one. Yeah, so this is basically, in a nutshell, the underlying worldview of materialistic culture. So now spiritual culture is based on the very opposite worldview. All we have to do is take the opposite. So instead of sense gratification, sex life being the all in all, we minimize, we try and keep it to a bare minimum with the goal of losing taste and attraction altogether. I mean, already there we see it can't be more opposite than that. Right? One culture is increasing it, one culture is decreasing it. I mean, my God, you know? So, and then also spiritual culture is designed to give up the bodily identification, to realize we're not the gross body, and to subdue and dissolve the subtle body of mind, intelligence, for the ego. That's what spiritual culture is designed, you know? And yeah, in order, and instead of under thinking I'm the supreme controller and joy proprietor, no, we put Krishna in the center, and I'm just tiny, insignificant, humble servant. That's my real position. And there is not only one life, there is many lives, and actually there is some reactions, and I can have some effect on my next destiny, actually. So there's the understanding of purifying duties. Purifying duties. That's what Bhagavad Gita is all about. You know, do your duty remembering Krishna. That understanding of material life and its culture is not there. Nobody talks about duty. As long as it feels good, do it. That's the motto, not duty. No. You know, so once we realize that, it makes it very clear. These two cultures are like day and night, actually. And interestingly, culture doesn't only come about by living a certain worldview, but it promotes that same worldview. It reinforces that same worldview in our consciousness and in other people's consciousness. It propagates that worldview very strongly, right? Yeah, you with me? Yes, yes, yes. So we should not think that these things are just some external details and they're not important for our life. And now, once we understand that, it makes it very clear that the more aspects of spiritual culture we invite in our life, the more it promotes that worldview which we want to develop, right? And the more we hang on to material aspects of materialistic culture, well, then that promotes that worldview. Huh? Yes. So, and we have that nice verse in Bhagavad Gita 2:69, where Krishna says, what is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled. And the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. So there we got it, you know, that these two worldviews and also cultures are actually as different as day and night. Actually, they're incompatible, really, if we look at it, you know. So now, of course, we have to understand we can have on one end of the spectrum is the day of the materialist. On the other end is the day of the spiritualist. And there is a broad spectrum in between. There's all kinds of mixtures and shades and grades there. It's like day turning into night. It doesn't happen from 1 second to the other, but there's dusk and dawn in between. There's the Brahma Muhurta in between. So it's a transformational thing there, gradual process. So in the same way, we can understand, okay, actually the process of Krishna consciousness is meant to bring about this transformation, that the day of the materialist eventually becomes our night. That's actually what Krishna consciousness is all about. And I have received such kind of transformation there over the last 20 years in Bangladesh, because my God, Bangladesh is the place to actually experience how our Vaishnav life is meant to be lived, how our philosophy is meant to be applied. Yes, it's really the place to get that experience. So yes, Krishna consciousness is meant to bring about this transformation. Actually, Krishna consciousness is meant to transform our likes, our dislikes, our tastes, our worldviews, our patterns of behaviors, our very heart, so that we can develop bhakti there. That's what Krishna consciousness is all about. We don't want to leave things as they are. No, we want to transform, actually, if we want to go back to Godhead, you know? Yes. So, and this transformation has to be done voluntarily, individually. We cannot impose this on people. We cannot force this on devotees, right? It can only be inspired. Yes. We cannot force. And it's an individual thing. Some people may not even want to transform, you know? But then some others may want to transform. So we have to give, you know, that space to each and everyone to make that transformation at their own pace. It can only be inspired, but it cannot be forced. And actually, let me spend a little bit of time just illustrating how this day-night principle actually accompanies us through so many aspects of devotional life. That really, what is right for a spiritualist and what is success for a spiritualist may very well be wrong and a failure for a materialist. For example, to develop the quality of tolerance. For a spiritualist, this is a highly important thing. You know, it's one of the main criteria to measure a person's spiritual strength and advancement and how tolerant that person can be. Because it is a sign of having subdued and dissolved the false ego. Because what stops us from being tolerant is the ego's demand, the ego protests. So for a spiritualist, to be tolerant is a sign of advancement. But then for a materialist, to be tolerant is a sign of weakness. Right? Yes. Their success is to stand up for yourself and fight and, you know, and not to tolerate. Right? Yes, yes. Often we hear these things even amongst devotees. Oh, I'm not going to tolerate that. Who does he think I am? Oh, I'm going to walk out. I get divorced. Oh, why should I tolerate this? You know, so that's the mundane view. You know, we are so conditioned by, you know, our surroundings. We don't realize because it's so subtle, so deep. We carry that conditioning very deeply. To actually really transform that, that requires a whole paradigm shift. Yeah, it's a whole thing, you know. And even also, you know, the quality of chastity and shyness for a lady, you know, in spiritual culture, that makes her into a jewel, a gem, you know, that brings out her extraordinary beauty, actually, a chaste woman, a shy woman. It's a whole thing. I'm discussing all these topics more deeply in this book. Yes. So, but in materialistic culture, a woman who is shy and chaste, huh? What's wrong with her? Maybe she needs some psychotherapy or something. You know, she doesn't know how to show off and, you know, and be cool and, you know. Yes, yes. I mean, I was once sitting in, many years ago in Australia next to one lady at the Sunday program, and she asked me, she came the first time to the temple, and she asked me this question, so why do you cover your head and this and that, the usual questions. And I mentioned this term chastity. And she looked at me and said, chastity? What's that? You know? And it was not a question of English or something. English is her mother tongue. But she can't even relate to the term of chastity. It's unknown. People don't use it. Same in German language. Keuschheit. My God, that sounds like something from the Middle Ages or something, you know? Yes, because people are not striving for this quality at all. And I mean, there's so many other examples. Even the quality of being inquisitive for spiritual progress, it's a highly important quality to be inquisitive. There's so many quotes in the Bhagavatam. When Prabhupada says, yeah, Parikshit Maharaj, he was perfectly inquisitive. He was a perfect disciple, you know. But then in material life, to ask a question means you're a fool. You don't know. You know what? You don't know? You really don't know this? I know, so how come you don't know? You know, some people feel embarrassed. They rather want to talk about themselves than inquiring and hearing. You know, so this day-night principle, we find that in so many aspects of devotional life, that what is success for a spiritualist is a failure and being a loser for a materialist. Even a few other examples, like our attitude to certain sections of society, like the attitude towards the elderly. In materialistic culture, the elderly people are seen as a burden, trouble, pushed aside, off into the retirement center, get them out of the way. They're stopping the sense gratification of the young generation. Huh? There's no care and respect and anything like that. You know, they can't enjoy, body is not suitable anymore for enjoyment, so they're out of the race for sense gratification. So then, but in spiritual life, the elders, they're a highly important section of the whole society. They embody wisdom, life experience, self-realization. They're meant to give the guidance and the advice and share, you know, their life experience. You know, they're really important. Similar thing is there with the children. In materialistic culture also, children, they're a burden, pushed aside, you know, and stopping the enjoyment of the parents. So that's why these days people put their babies 6 weeks old, they put them in daycare centers, you know, because they want to enjoy life. So, but in spiritual culture, the children are the center. I've experienced it in Bangladesh. I mean, if we had more time, I could tell you so many stories, you know. Yes, but I've seen it, how the children in Bangladesh, they are the center. Yes. I took some 10, 12-year-old boys from Ukraine with their parents to Bangladesh. And in Ukraine, they were known not to be devotees. They didn't show any interest in Krishna consciousness. But then in Bangladesh, wow, they were flourishing, blossoming. They came to life. The parents were shocked. Wow, what's happening with our child here, our son? You know, yeah, and that was my eye-opener in regards to children, that I realized, my God, we are doing something wrong. You know, yes, because of that attitude. You know, yes. Yeah, and even mothers. In materialistic culture, being a mother is almost a disgrace. What? You're only mother and housewife? Is that all you're doing? My God, what are you doing all day? You know? Yes. It's the last thing to be a mother. Doesn't get any appreciation and respect and you know, oh, you're the doormat. You know, you're the slave at home. You can't enjoy life. That's the understanding of mother. But then in spiritual culture, and I'm also talking about that in this book, in spiritual culture, mothers are the most important personalities in human society. It's the mother. She's the backbone. Yes. She's the first guru of the living entity. She plants the seed of bhakti in the child's heart. She creates the whole spiritual and religious atmosphere in the home and thus in whole human society. It's the mother. Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, my God, you know, this day and night principle accompanies us in so many aspects of Krishna consciousness. And we are heavily conditioned. We are surrounded. We are bombarded by all this materialistic understanding. And we take that very easily into our spiritual life. And we think this is the way it's meant to be, you know, without understanding. Actually, we're meant to have a whole paradigm shift here and transform, you know. So my approach is that I'm thinking, if we actually give systematic education and training to our devotees, that we know, we understand what Krishna's system is meant to look like, only then we can make a conscious decision how much of each culture we want to have in our life. Right? But if that education is not there, then we just easily go with the flow. Whatever anybody does around us, what's modern and progressive, you know, we just go along the flow with that. And we don't even realize how most of these principles and ideas, which are modern today, well, they're actually not conducive to spiritual development because of the day-night principle. Right? Yes. So that's why I think the main approach in this whole matter is systematic training and education. Yes. And that will empower our devotees to actually make a conscious decision, to decide how much of which culture do I want to have. And if everybody actually has that understanding what Krishna's system looks like, then we also have a target, you know, towards which we should move. And this will take generations. This cannot be done overnight. No, no. I've heard Prabhupada disciples saying that apparently, but I never found the quote, that Prabhupada said, this will take 10 generations. Wow. So it will take time. But I think it's very exciting to be a tiny little part of this. And somewhere we have to start. I do feel we have to start with this. And yes, so but we need to know the target, what Krishna's system looks like. And interestingly, in the spiritual world, there is also Krishna's culture. There is. You know? Yes. It's not that on the spiritual world there's something else happening or something. I mean, just 2 mornings ago we had a whole verse and purport where the topic was Krishna himself sets the example. And this is also in the spiritual world. Krishna's culture is going on there. There's no, I mean, I don't want to open up this topic today, but just as a little comment. In the spiritual world, there is no confusion over the gender issues. You know, Nanda Maharaj is doing his role, and Mother Yashoda is doing her role. They're playing their roles according to the spiritual form that they have received. It's not that, you know, Mother Yashoda all of a sudden wants to do Nanda Maharaj's job or something. There's no confusion like that. You know? Yes. So That's why I'm thinking, you know, if we really want to go there one day, to Goloka Vrindavan, we have to, you know, practice the culture already here, and then our communities become Goloka Vrindavan. Yeah? Yes. And we can actually say, all our social problems we are facing in Kali Yuga, inside is gone, outside is gone, I see them as global reactions for not following Krishna's system. Yes. You know? In Krishna's system, there is no room for divorce and single motherhood and neglected children and violence towards women and all these things don't exist in Krishna's system. But our modern disease is that we think our modern system is better than Krishna's system. And we think Krishna's system is outdated and old-fashioned, and who will accept Krishna consciousness if we offer things with Krishna's system? And that's our disease somewhat, you know. And I am illustrating these things all in the book. Actually, in the book you will find spiritual solutions for any material problem. Not any, but many, many material problems. Yes, and that was always what Prabhupada was saying. You know, that any material problem has a spiritual solution. And I mean, what would be the value of Krishna consciousness if we cannot offer a spiritual solution to all these things? And this book is a humble attempt to give some little insights. I mean, I find it highly interesting, you know, how Krishna actually puts all the right qualities and natures in the male body and the women's body so that all the roles can be played nicely, and how it is all meant to fit together so that there's stability and harmony in the world. I find this highly interesting. And fascinating, even. Yeah. So now, the last few minutes, I do want to leave a little bit of time for questions, but I want to address one really important thing. Because, as probably most of us know, in ISKCON there is quite a bit of tension over this topic of culture, right? Are we aware of this? Yes? No? You're not bold enough to say this. Well, I'm bold enough to sit here so and give some little presentation on this. Now, there is quite a bit of tension, you know, between the liberal people and then between the more conservative and traditional people. So I want to, and there is a whole chapter in this book on this topic. Why so much tension over the topic of culture? And I just quickly want to present a few little thoughts on this. So the tension comes about because we try and establish what's right and what's wrong. That's what brings the tension in. Our philosophy is absolute, but then how we apply it depends on where we want to be on the spectrum between the day of the materialist and the day of the spiritualist. We cannot say what is right and wrong, what a woman should do and not do, what a man should do and not do. No, wrong approach, wrong approach. And I get this all the time that people say, ask me, oh, is it okay for a woman to do this and this and this? No, wrong approach. We are not establishing what's right and wrong. We are just trying to give insights into Krishna's system. And then it's up to each and every one where they want to be on the spectrum. You know? So we cannot say what is right and what is wrong. What is right for a person who is still more towards the day of the materialist will be wrong towards a devotee who has already more transformed, right? And vice versa. What's right for the person who has already more transformed will be completely wrong and unacceptable for a person who is more towards the day of the materialist. Actually, in the book, I'm sharing some examples, you know, which I have experienced, encountered in Bangladesh, how something can be completely right in Bangladesh and anywhere outside of Bangladesh, it can be a scandal. Yes, within ISKCON. That's how, you know, that's an example that we cannot establish what is right and what is wrong. It depends on how much we have transformed. Yes. And that's where we are stuck. That's why we have this tension, you know, because the liberals are trying to, you know, convince the more traditional people this is right, and vice versa. And then there is tension. It's not a question of right and wrong. It's not black and white. The process of Krishna consciousness is a dynamic process. It's all about transformation. So what may be right in the very beginning of our devotional life, hopefully 20 years later, it will be wrong because we have transformed. Hopefully. Right? Yes, yes. So we cannot approach this topic of culture in these terms of what's right and wrong. But one thing is very important, that we have to have respect towards each and every devotee where he or she wants to be on that spectrum, how much they have transformed. There has to be mutual respect. Mutual respect, you know? But if we start to attack each other, criticize, pull each other down, reject each other, condemn each other, you know, then we never get anywhere here. Yes, yes. So there has to be mutual respect, because let's be honest. That's the second point. It requires humility and honesty to be able to say, well, sorry, I actually like it in the day of the materialist. I feel more comfortable there. You know, it satisfies my senses more. I want to be at that side. Not everybody wants to transform. That's the whole point. So, but it requires some humility and some introspection and some honesty to say, well, sorry, that's where I'm at. I still have the taste of materialistic culture and lifestyle. And that's where I want to be for this lifetime. And I just want to do a little bit of chanting and reading Prabhupada's books and have a little bit of Krishna consciousness in my life. But sorry, that's where I want to stay. Okay, fine. But let's be honest and humble to admit that. You know? Yes, yes. And not criticize and attack those who want to transform. Because that's what we are experiencing, you know? But that humility and honesty is not always there to actually say, yes, I want to stay at that end of the spectrum. I still have that attachment, you know? Yes. So that's the whole thing. If we want to really, you know, bring about what Prabhupada wanted, this unity and diversity, right? Prabhupada wrote these famous letters and so on, unity and diversity. So that we will only get if there's respect there and humility and honesty. And we know we are educated in what Krishna's system is meant to look like, and we, you know, have that respect for those who want to be closer to Krishna's system, and also for those who want to be still a little further away. That respect has to be there, and the honesty and self-reflection and humility has to be there. And then we get forward, you know, then we can move forward. Yeah, so I feel, you know, there we are a little stuck, you know. And we will only overcome this when we can actually muster up this respect and humility and honesty. And then the tension will be solved, hopefully. You know? But I am firmly convinced that, you know, if we actually come to this point where we can really live our philosophy and show the world this practical application of how civilized human cultured life is meant to be lived, that will make Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement powerful. Yes. But as long as we are confused and as long as we are struggling with pretty much the same social problems like the outside world, well, what do we got to show? Not that much. You know, some great books and nice deities and prasadam, but we have to get to stage number two. We have to actually live, you know, our philosophy. And then we can actually demonstrate to the world, you know, how life is meant to be lived, you know. And there is people out there who realize something is going wrong. Something is going in the wrong direction. There is people who are looking for an alternative lifestyle and culture, and we've got something to offer. But first, we have to get it right, you know, within our society before we really can offer something. Okay, so let me finish here and see if we have any comments or questions.